Hey, this is Hal Hester. I'm the pastor of Vineyard Christian Church, and this is our podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today. I hope this message inspires you, builds your faith, and gives you perspective on how God is moving in your life. Please enjoy the message.
Hey, go ahead and turn, if you will, in your Bibles to Ruth chapter 2. And as you're getting there, let me just share just some news with you. This week, I was down in Miami at our national, it's called the Multiply Vineyard Summit. It is our annual gathering where we spend all of our energy talking to people about planting churches, about starting new churches. And we have a goal of there being 10,000 vineyard churches in the United States. Right now, we are a long way from that yet, really. We've got about 2,000 worldwide. But one of the desires is to put a church in every county. In particular, 2,000 counties in the United States are rural counties like ours, with a courthouse and not a whole lot else going on there. And so one of the things that we've been doing is putting a lot of energy into small towns. So that's what I did this week. I was there talking to people about planting churches in small town America, and talking a little bit about you guys and telling them how wonderful you are and giving them lots of reasons to want to come to small town America and plant a church. Very excited. And so we had a couple of hundred people there, 50 churches represented that were looking to send someone out to plant. I was very excited about that. We also had 80 people who were in the discernment process, just spending time asking the question, what is God doing in my life? Is he stirring me to plant a church? Is God wanting to use me in some other particular way? But they were there for the discernment process. So I spent half my week with them and half my week with people talking about small town. And then the other thing that was going on was just we had another 50 church planters who are currently in the process. And we were just trying to encourage them and fill them up and make sure that they felt well taken care of and loved. And anyhow, I would ask you to go ahead and continue praying for all of those who were at the conference this past week, and pray that God would just really open up things for them, show them very clearly what it is they're supposed to do. I'd love for those 50 churches to send out those 80 persons, and that'd be really great. Very exciting. Well, anyhow, Ruth chapter 2. You know, when you think about big events in your life, you can probably tell me a lot of the details about those days. When those big events happened, you can tell me what things were going on. You might even be able to tell me things that seem obscure about those days. I can remember very clearly on September 11th, 2001, when the towers came down, that I had kind of a slow morning that day. I just was not moving very quickly, and I spent some time with my kids. Just took a lot longer to get moving. Then I was in my truck, and I was driving into town to go to the church. Our church was in a downtown area, and we lived kind of out in the country. And I was driving in my truck, and I remember when Carl Leibensperger gave me a phone call, and he said, "Are you by chance listening to the radio? Where are you? I mean, what are you doing right at this moment?" And I said, "I'm in my truck listening to a CD on my way to work." And then you called. That's the excitement of my day. He goes, "Well, your day's about to get really exciting in just a moment. Turn on the radio. Something big has really just happened." And so I turned on the radio. And what I was thinking was really going to be big that day is that we were going to celebrate my mom's 70th birthday. And so then after I listened to the radio for a few moments, my next phone call was, "Hey, Mom, I don't think we're going to be doing your birthday party tonight, but instead we're going to be having a prayer meeting at church." I remember those details, and I remember all that was going on in that way. Maybe some of you remember the day that if you're married, that you first met your spouse, you know, when you first laid eyes on them. I remember that very distinctly because it was actually years before I ever got to know my wife. We just met at someone else's house. I was literally leaving to go back to school, and she was coming from school to be with some friends for the weekend, and we passed in the driveway, and I thought she was somebody else's boyfriend, and I was like, wow, he got her? Like, really? Those things that you can remember about specific events. But here's the thing. Most of us have no memory on what we did, say, last Tuesday. If I asked you what you were doing last Tuesday, you'd probably have to think for a little bit, and the chances are that it wasn't anything big or significant. You may not remember what you did or what you ate for the day or anything like that. I doubt many of you will remember exactly what I preached about in November. I hardly remember what I preached about in November. And so, if you're asked, you can remember the significant events in your life, but if you have no particular event, not a wedding, not a funeral, not a graduation or something like that, chances are that those days just tend to slip into the past and you think very little of them. But the truth is this: legacy is rarely built on extraordinary events, but on the ordinary ones. You see, children don't remember the big vacations. In fact, one of the things that was most disappointing to me, I remember that we were at a conference one year out in Southern California, and we booked our hotel to be there at this conference. And as we got settled for the evening, went back to our room, and we parked the car over on the side parking lot. And as I started to walk from the side parking lot back into the building, it occurs to me that in my peripheral vision, there is an amusement park. And I stopped and I looked and, oh no, I brought my kids to California with no money for Disney. And it's not just Disney. We are like right next door to Disney. Like, you can see the rides and everything. And so every morning as we're going to conference to be spiritual, I have to walk my kids by and feel like a jerk, you know, like just walking by my kids going, oh, Daddy, what's that? Oh, that looks interesting, you know, and they're like all excited, and I'm feeling about this big, you know, and so I'm like going, what am I going to do? And we're trying to scrape together the money. We're like, you know, ready to go beg out on the corner, you know, or something. And we'll work for food. I don't know, something, you know. We're trying to figure this out. And then our parents found out what was going on. And they said, hey, we got together and we put money in your account. We were living in Michigan at that time. We put money in your account and you can use your check card and you can just go to Disney. Isn't that wonderful? I was like, great. And so we went to Disney. We had this great, you know, time. And I thought, man, I was a great parent. Do you know how much my kids remember that trip? Like, my oldest can tell you that we even went, okay? And all the others were like, no, I don't. We went to Disney? I don't remember that. I mean, and so here I am worried that I was going to ruin their lives. And they, of course, at least they would have had something to talk about in counseling. But, now they have nothing to talk about. But anyhow, no, that's not true either. But anyhow, children don't usually remember the big vacations. But they do remember the way that you made them feel when you played family games. Hello? Widows don't typically measure the value of their spouse by the achievements that their spouse achieved, or even how nice a wedding they had. I've never heard once a widow tell me, boy, you should have seen the size of our wedding. It was bigger than Jenny's. It was more elaborate than the Smiths. Never heard anybody tell me that. I've heard them tell me all about the way that they behaved every day, and I've heard them talk about how they handled times of sickness or loss or financial struggles, how they stuck it out together. I've heard them talk about a beloved favorite meal, not the specifics of when those events, but that how they loved gathering for those family meals and how important it was to be together. You build your legacy not in the extraordinary events, but in the most ordinary. How do you make them feel? How did you spend your time? Who or what gets your attention? You build an extraordinary legacy in the middle of the ordinary. Take a look with me, if you will, at Ruth chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. I'm going to be reading from the English Standard Version, Please follow along in whatever translation you have. As always, the one in your lap's my favorite because that's the one you're reading. Ruth chapter 2, beginning of verse 1, and we read, "Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, 'Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I find favor.' And she said to her, 'Go, my daughter.' So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, 'The Lord be with you.' And they answered, 'The Lord bless you.' And then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, 'Whose young woman is this?' And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, 'She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers." So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to the young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, to go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsels in the wine." And she sat beside the reapers, and he passed roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied and even had some left over. And when she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean among the sheaves and do not reproach her. Also put out some of the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening, and then she beat out what had been gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley, and she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she brought her out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "This man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" So Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with these young women, lest in another field you be assaulted. So keep close to the young men of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and the wheat harvest." And she lived with her mother-in-law. Blessed be the reading of God's holy word. So let me help you connect the dots, if you didn't already, in the beginning of this. Naomi's husband, Ruth's mother-in-law, her father-in-law was Elimelech. So Elimelech is related to them through marriage. In other words, he is not blood kin to Naomi. He certainly is of no relation to Ruth. Boaz is a close relative of Elimelech, and so he's kin. But in this whole thing, he really has very little responsibility to them. Now, understand this, that in the Old Testament, it's very clear in the Old Testament law that one of the things that's important is to take care of family. Always very important. In fact, even in the New Testament, one of the things that we're reminded is said that those who do not take care of their family are worse off than an unbeliever. Hello? If you do not take care of your family, you are worse off than an unbeliever. There's this whole sense of expectation that we take care of our kin. It's very important in our relationships. And so one of the expectations is that when someone is widowed, they did not have our social systems like we have in place now, where we have, things like welfare or food stamps and anything like that. Nothing like that existed. And also remember that women's rights were nothing like, I know, you might listen today and think that we don't have any women's rights, sometimes listen to the media, but in comparison to that day, women have tremendous rights. And so in that day and age, here's what was normative, is that once a woman's husband died, that she would either A, go back to her parents' house, who would take care of her, or B, if she were still of good health and beauty, she might find a husband and get married. But the idea of establishing her own household, having her own means, working her own job was not possible, was not happening. And so oftentimes what happened to women in those situations was that they got taken care of by some man who didn't want to marry her, just kind of used her as a household person and probably used her in other ways at his discretion. It's very difficult for a woman to lose her husband. But she was young, and so there was still the possibilities. Remember in chapter 1, if you were here, if you weren't, let me just catch you up really quickly. Her husband dies. Her father-in-law died. Then her husband dies. And so she is alone in the world except for her mother-in-law. But her mother-in-law has done such a great job of caring for her and loving her that when mother-in-law is going back to the Jews, and she's a Moabite, the children of Lot, longtime enemies of the people of Israel, when she's going back to her hometown of Bethlehem in the middle of nowhere, a big nothing town, a town that was very unimportant, just hundreds of people, not even thousands of people, she says, I'm going to go with you because God has been so good to me through you, and God forbid that I would abandon you now. I'm going to take care of you, mother-in-law. I'm going to take care of you, Naomi, because of the great influence that you've been in my life, because you've been so wonderful to me. And so begins this kind of picture of legacy in this, that Naomi has been such a great mother-in-law, that Ruth is willing to go with her to a foreign land with no promises and likely the chance of being mistreated. Now, when we get to Israel, one of the things is the way that they took care of their poor, one of the primary ways they took care of their poor was that they were allowed to go in the fields behind the workers and glean. In other words, that is that after the reapers were done picking things, that whatever fell to the ground or whatever got missed in the hustle and bustle of getting to the other end of the field, you could not go back and rework the field a second time. That what the Old Testament taught was that whatever was left behind after the first pass, whatever fell to the ground, that those things belonged to those who were poor. Those were where the people had a chance to glean. And the gleaners were typically women that would go into the field and they would pick up the leftovers. And that is how they would eat. That was how a lot of women made ends meet who didn't have a husband. They gleaned, and that was all they had to eat, whatever was left over in the field. But as you can imagine, workers get paid by the bushel, by the basketful. And so what's the temptation of every worker? To go back through the field one more time and get what was left over so that they can get paid a little more. Because they're thinking to themselves, why should I be worried about the poor? I'm the working class poor. We're barely making ends meet. And so I ought to just go right back through the field instead. I'm working for a living, was the attitude. And so oftentimes what would happen as the gleaners would go into the field to work is that they would be assaulted by the young men working or by the people working because they wanted to chase them out of the field to make sure that there was plenty for them to go back through another time and maybe get a little bit more, maybe get another bushel or a couple of bushels more so that they could pad their paycheck at the end of it. And here's the thing is that it was very clear to those who were landowners and things like that, that they were supposed to allow the gleaners to glean. But they didn't have much motivation other than the fact that the law said that they should. Because here's the thing, is that giving to the poor, feeding those who are hungry, didn't come out of your tithes. Hello? Remember that there were three different tithes that they paid in the Old Testament. See, people get upset when you talk about tithing. We talk about one tithe. In the Old Testament, there are three different tithes. There's the tithe to take care of the Levites. That's to take care of the priests, to make sure that they're taken care of. There's the tithe that takes care of the temple or tabernacle. There is another about 13% in different offerings that are given, of course, through the course of the year in terms of grain offerings and animal sacrifices and something like that. So about 33% of your income went to just maintaining those things without ever considering the poor. And so if you're a landowner, you're thinking to yourself, well, I've already done my tithing. I gave at the office. I gave at church. I did, you know, everything I was supposed to do. And so there wasn't a real sense of that, of responsibility to do those things and to take care of the people that way. And so oftentimes, when their workers were working hard and would want to go back through the field, they did nothing to stop them. They just let them rush off the gleaners because it was of no consequence to them. Now, add to that, that Ruth is a foreigner. And not just any foreigner. She is a foreigner from a land where the people, they have contempt for. You know, I mean, just think about some land that we have been at odds with as a nation. And imagine those persons are coming and they're gleaning from your field. And it'd be really easy for you to just kind of look down on them, have contempt for them, have disrespect for them, maybe make some comment about why don't they speak, you know, Hebrew and things like that. And to just kind of have contempt for those persons without thinking about them as persons. So she goes into the field and she's trying to make ends meet. She's working really hard. And one of the things that Boaz, when he comes into the field, he can't help but take notice of her. Now, maybe it was because of her beauty. You know, I mean, maybe she's stark raving beautiful. I don't know. It doesn't say that in the text. It doesn't say anything about her beauty. On top of that, beauty sometimes is in the eye of the beholder. One, two, beauty in that day and age probably would be defined a bit different than we would define it today. But nonetheless, see, it doesn't say anything about her beauty. What it says is that he noticed her because she was a hard worker. Now, maybe he noticed that she was a foreigner as well. I don't know. He didn't say that. Certainly the other guy mentions it. But the big thing that he notices is that she's working really hard out there in the field, and she's not one of the workers. And so he says to his head man, he goes, hey, what's the story there? I mean, like, she's out there and she's working really hard. And he goes, oh, yeah. Oh, man, she's working really hard. I mean, in fact, you know what? She has, other than just a couple of short breaks, she has worked all morning long. She's kept up with everybody. She's doing a great job out there and minding her own business, stayed out of the areas that she should stay out of. She's been no problem whatsoever. What makes her stand out is that she's a hard worker. That's what the Bible says in this. So she wins his attention based on her hard work. And then he asks the question, well, who is she? I mean, what is she doing here with our folks? By now he's asking that second question. I mean, she's a Moabite. What's she doing here in Israel? I mean, why is she here working with us? Do you know her story? I mean, is she just traveling through? Is she passing through? What's going on? Oh, no. This is Ruth, Naomi's daughter. You know your kin. Now, understand, I mean, keep in mind, this is loosely calling kin, right? I mean, you know, she's not of their family line. He's not married to any of those persons any longer or anything like that. So they're loosely kin. And he says, no, you know, this is this is Ruth. And you remember the story. She brought Naomi back. She stood by her. What she's doing is she's even providing for her mother-in-law. And Boaz is impressed by her character. First, by her hard work in the field, gleaning after the workers. Second, because he knows that she literally does not have any obligation, but she is there out of because of the kind of character she has and who she has become as a person. And so he looks at those two things, her work ethic and her character, and he decides to help her out. Now, one of the things that's important that I just a side note here, I want to mention to my young ladies. As he extends himself, extends his kindness to her, she voices concern. Hello? She voices concern. Why are you doing this for me? Because she knows two things. She knows, A, she is a foreigner. Two, she knows that it's common for young women to get assaulted in those fields. And then she doesn't know who he is. Remember, it's not like she said, oh, let me go over to our kinsman redeemer's field because he owes us. It was nothing like that. She had no idea whose field it was. She just simply found a place where they would let her work. It seemed profitable, and she got involved there, and she starts working hard, but she doesn't know who he is. So she shows discernment and wisdom. She's not naive. And so I would just say to young women everywhere, protect yourself. When a man you don't know is overly nice to you without reason, believe me, there is always a reason. See, I'm a guy. I've already told my daughters that guys always have a reason. There's a reason. So you ought to find out what that reason is. In this case, Boaz was a righteous man, and his motives are right. His desire is to bless Ruth for her kindness and faithfulness, to bless Naomi through Ruth, knowing that she's providing for her mother-in-law. And so, and more than that, here's the other thing, is that he knows as a foreigner that she did not from birth grow up knowing the God of Israel. And so he wants to make sure that she gets a testimony that the God of Israel is the God of all. He says, listen, you came and you asked for refuge in the Lord God Almighty, in the God of Israel. And so he was determined to make sure that she knew that his God was truly God. So his motives are that, one, he saw that she was a hard worker. Second, that she has character herself. And third, he is determined to bless Naomi. And then lastly, he wants the God of Israel to get credit. He wants her to see that the God of Israel is bigger than any other God and that his God is able to care for her wherever she may go. Now, remember what I said about God using the ordinary to do the extraordinary. Think about the fact that when we think through things, what we know about people and what it is that God is doing in our life, how sometimes just the smallest things can be evidence of the way that God is working in our life. But here's the thing. In everything you do, you are building your legacy. So in this case, we're watching the early courtship of Ruth and Boaz. And one of the things that is he's looking at her and considering things. I don't know what's in his heart at this point. It doesn't say that he's romantically inclined to her or anything else. It's just simply that they're getting to know one another and he's watching her and sees the kind of person they are. And so one of the things I always tell, I always told my kids, is to continue to tell my kids, is, to continue to tell the young people in our congregation or single adults, is that when you're considering that boy or that girl, that man or that young woman, you might ask yourself the question, does this person help me fulfill the plan of God in my life or are they hindering my walk with God? See, here's the thing, is that very rarely whenever someone's, you know, going through those relationships and courting and things like that, is there any thought in their mind that maybe I'm building a legacy by the way I'm behaving right now in this moment? You know, whenever we're at work and we're doing the things that we do at work and we're letting people do things or not do things and we're relating to people that we work with, maybe the people that we're supervisor over, and it's really easy for us to think in those things that what does this have to do with God's plan for my life? Especially, you know, maybe in this case, they're working a field. You know, they might just say to themselves, I'm just working for some food here. I'm just harvesting. I'm just planting. I mean, what does this have to do with building the kingdom of God? See, oftentimes we confuse this idea that calling is something that pastors get. We get this idea that what I do for a living, that's when you're called. And we use that language so often. And if someone goes to a new church or whatever, they were called. I'm always curious, why is it they're always seeming to be called to a bigger church with more money? But anyhow, but they always get a calling, right? It's always a calling. But what about your calling? Why are you doing what you do? See, Boaz is a farmer. And it'd be really easy for him in that moment to think that he's just a farmer. But legacy is built in those ordinary moments. The people he's relating to are finding out that there is a law in Israel, and that law says that we take care of those who are on the fringes, that it's our responsibility to feed and to help them, and as God has blessed us, that we want to bless in the same way. That we do not hold on to everything, to every last gleaning, but instead that we're open-handed, believing that the God who fills those hands is also the God who sifts those things through our fingers to fall to the ground for the sake of others. That he blesses, that his very nature is abundance. I mean, have you ever looked at an apple tree? No, you're in Florida. Never mind. Let me explain this. I lived in Michigan for like 10 years, and we had these things called apple trees. You know apples that you get in a bag, you know, like for $3 for this little pitiful. Anyhow, we get these apples, and you cut an apple open. And inside are those seeds, right? That part you're not supposed to eat, the part you're supposed to spit out. And there's those seeds, and there's, what, 10 seeds or so in every apple? And on the tree there are literally hundreds, sometimes thousands of apples weighing that tree down, and many of them fall to the ground. And all it takes is one seed to bear a tree that will bear thousands of apples with thousands of seeds. And every season, more apples and more apples. See, God is not the God of scarcity. That's the way we run our economy, because it makes us lots of money. But God is not the God of scarcity. He does not function on scarcity. Right. He is the God of abundance. Yes. And so everything he does has the evidence of abundance in it. And whenever we participate in it, we see that. We see God working through the abundance, and we don't worry about those things. And when we live in the mindset of scarcity, we are living in the mindset of the world where we're constantly worried about what might slip through our fingers. So Boaz is building legacy because not only does he do the things that are the obvious things at temple when he's required to do, but he's allowing God to just bring people onto his land and to glean, and he's blessing. And when he sees what's happening, his first thought, he said, who is she? He didn't say, is that okay? He just wants to know who she is. He's keeping stock of things. He's aware of what's going on. He does. And then, even so, as he realizes who she is, he says, man, I want you to know that the God in whom you have taken refuge, the God of Israel, that he is really God. And that he can provide for you, even as he's providing for me and for everybody on that's working this field. The confidence in the nature of who God is. He's building legacy. He's saying something about the character and nature of God. He's saying something about what he believes about the law, that the law is good, rejoicing the heart. He's not looking at the law as something that he must do or must keep, but he's looking at the idea of being in relationship with God and how he relates to God and to man through that law, and he believes that the law is good, and so he's living the law. I didn't say he kept it perfectly. I said, he's living the law, and the testimony is that he believes in who God is, and here's the testimony even to his workers and to the foreigners who are far off. My God is able. I'm not worried about those things. He's building a legacy. He's also building a legacy in that how he relates to her. As he begins to take stock of her, he's taking stock of the things that stand out about her. But so far, nothing's been said about her looks. Now, listen, we'll find out later on that he's quite smitten with her. I mean, as we go through the chapter, in fact, the Hebrew kind of like hides how much, we don't like to translate those things. Trust me, he was very smitten with her, okay? And so there's no question about that. But at this point, nothing's been said. He's just watching her. He's watching her character. He's watching the way she's doing things. And see, Boaz is living out of a place that he wants God's will done in his life. He wants to follow the calling that is on his life. He's not just a farmer. You're not just an insurance salesman. You're not just a garbage collector. You're not just a fireman. You're not just a politician. You're not just. You're called. And you're building a legacy. And so Boaz, that's what he's doing. And the keys to legacy are in the midst of love and loss. You don't suddenly build a legacy at 50. You don't suddenly build a legacy because you decide in your old age that you ought to do things better or different or whatever else. You're building a legacy based on the weight of your life and the direction of it. Now, I'm not saying that it's how you start out, because it really is about how you finish. Can I just be honest? I knew guys in Bible college who started out like superstars and then absolutely wrecked their life before we got out of Bible college. Or within a year or two. And the reality is, of all the people I graduated with, from my Bible college in 1989, there are two of us that are still in full-time ministry. So it really does matter how you finish more than how you start. But from where you are to where you finish is an opportunity to build a legacy. But it doesn't happen just in those big events. It doesn't happen whenever you think to yourself, I'm building a legacy. See, the legacy that I'm leaving my children began before I ever took breath, when I first met their mother and was asking questions about the kind of person that I wanted to marry. One of the things that were primary in my frame of reference at that point was I wanted to marry someone who would love God more than they loved me. Because I knew at some point I wasn't going to be very lovable. I knew at some point I was going to do and say things that would not be very lovable. Here's the other part, is I wanted to make sure that I loved God more than I loved her, because I knew there were going to be times when she would be less than lovely and less than likable. And so out of my love for God, I wanted to know that I would be able to be faithful no matter what. And I wanted to know that she would be faithful no matter what, out of our love for God. And then secondly, our love for one another. So we were building a legacy from the very beginning. We were building a legacy with our grandchildren before we ever became grandparents. Because before I ever asked their grandmother to marry me, not only was I making sure that Jesus was the king of my heart and the king of her heart, but I was thinking about what it meant to find a godly wife who would not only love me and love my children, but I was thinking to myself, someday I'm going to be old. Someday I'm going to be old. And I'm going to tell my children and my grandchildren stories about my life. And the story I don't want to tell is how out of my own selfishness I ran off and did things and was destructive to my family. And so I was building a legacy before I ever asked her to marry me. And Boaz was building a legacy before he ever knew that Ruth had his heart when he was just a farmer. We built a legacy when we were planting churches and didn't have money for groceries. You know how? By our children watching what we did and how we handled those things and how we treated others in the midst of that. Our legacy was being built when someone slipped a note under my door threatening my life and the life of my family because they didn't like the way things were going in the church. We were building a legacy when we were adopting our daughter Emma in Mexico and a Border Patrol agent asked me for money to make everything go easier. We were building a legacy in those moments. See, nobody would have known. But I would know. And so right here in their very first meeting, the foundation of the relationship, a legacy is being established. In whom will I put my hope? And how will I choose who I will join my life to? Not just in terms of a spouse, but even in terms of the people I do business with and how I do business with. Listen, these young men that were working the field, when it says those young men were out there working the field, they had already been treating her with deference and kindness. Because why? Because they knew that's the way that Boaz treats the reapers and the gleaners. Boaz had already established as a young man and establishing his fields that we obey the law of our God and we treat the gleaners that are out in the field with deference. And so he was already doing just exactly what he knew that his boss would want. And so the gleaners glean and the reapers reap. And they're following the commands of the Old Testament. You know what's interesting though? Never at any point in time does Boaz say, well, are you obeying the law? Never at any point in time do the young men say, you know, the reason we did this was because, you know, we wanted to be right before the Lord. We were trying to keep the law to the nth degree. It's never said. In fact, one of the curiosities about the book of Ruth is that other than the dialogue, the Lord is not mentioned. There's no reference to the law or anything. What we see is people living that law out. See, here's the thing is that what story does for us in the Old Testament is it tells us how God lives and dwells with his people, and it shows us how to live and to dwell with God, to understand how people relate and how they fall and how they get up and how they do life again, so that we recognize this God of mercy and grace, how he's working in the midst of all the things, the different events of our life, even down to the most boring thing like gleaning a field because you're hungry. Even down to sensing the call of God on your life because you're just a farmer. Just a teacher. How do we know to live that life and how it looks? We just look through the stories. And we see the unfolding of what it means that in the middle of love and loss, to build a legacy. You see, here's the thing. You and I both know this. That just because they lived in Israel and they knew the law of the Old Testament doesn't mean that everyone did what the law said. Have you noticed that? I mean, like that, like every Christian you meet doesn't just do what the word says. I mean, maybe you realized that when you looked in the mirror this morning, that maybe every Christian doesn't do exactly what the law says at all the time. See, sometimes it doesn't really matter what the law says. The question is how are we living the law? How are we living according and to step with the word of God? And in this case, they're just doing life. And what we see is their character emerging, her character emerging, their sense of utter expectancy that God will provide, and their willingness to give of everything they have because of it. Now, you and I know that he's fallen in love with her. You and I know that because we can look at the Bible, that what is going to happen is that the generations of their family are going to make a huge impact on the world right up to today. But here's the thing. It's one of the things I love about the Bible. The Bible is so refreshingly honest. So we find out that David, the man with a heart after God, was a murderer and adulterer. We find out that Solomon, his son, behaved in a lot of the same way and you know, was certainly chasing lots of skirts. And I guarantee you, he wasn't checking out their character before he married them. Not when he has hundreds of wives. David's sons hated him. Absalom tried to kill and overthrow him. And so his legacy as a king might be impressive in terms of the wealth he gained and the influence he had over a great number of people, but in terms of his family, it wasn't very impressive. As a daddy, he was downright shameful. In contrast, Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz are building a legacy of faithfulness to God and of family that will set a foundation for generations to come. A legacy of faithfulness and integrity, of serving God and trusting God, not in extraordinary moments of heroism like David, or grandiose events like Solomon, but in everyday life, picking crops, loving extended family and strangers, taking care of ordinary people, and even helping the poor when no one was checking the boxes to say that they had done the right thing. You see, here's the thing that I'm noticing about Boaz. In the Bible, there is more about stewardship of your stuff than any and money more than any other subject in both testaments. The message is repeatedly, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And as I said, many of the landowners ignored the biblical directives about reapers and gleaners and felt like they had already done enough and so forth. But can I tell you that how you interact with the stuff that's left in your pockets says a whole lot more than the 10% that you drop in a box. What the heart holds on to as belonging to the Lord, and what the heart holds on to as belonging to self, tells us more about our character than probably anything else. See, a heart that begrudgingly gives 10% out of duty is fallen victim to legalism. Can I just remind you that nowhere in this point does he ever say, well, you know what the law says, and this is why we should do this. It never comes into view. Not once. And I've often said this probably to the church's detriment, but, you know, if you don't want to give, then don't. The last thing I want to do is twist someone's arm or manipulate them to be blessed by the Lord. I just really. But can I tell you that there's something that's happening here in the way that he relates to everything in his circumstances that speaks of the very character and heart of God as you watch it in the life of Boaz. How he encounters a woman that he doesn't know, and as we follow that relationship through to them falling in love and getting married. As we look at how he relates with the people who work for him and in his fields, and how he continues to relate to them through that process. As he relates to Naomi, a distant relative, and concern about her well-being and her welfare, not because of what he has to do. In fact, there's someone else in line first before him, and he jumps the line in order to fulfill the things that he thinks that God is going to do in his life or wants to do in his life. In the ordinary events of life, you see, he's constantly looking for the way to do what God would have him to do. But yet never once is there the thing of, so what do I have to do? Never once is there the question of, what am I required to do? What does the law say? How do I get through this? You know, here's the thing is that over and over again, the heart of God is evident in Boaz because Boaz has a heart for God. And you see that heart of God in every place he goes and in everything he does. You build a legacy, not in the extraordinary, but in your ordinary. And when we look at Boaz, we find an ordinary man working his fields, living a simple life in a little town called Bethlehem. He has no idea what God has planned for him. He has no idea that the hope of the world will come from his lineage. He is simply obeying God, living right, and falling in love in a godly way. He does not know that his offspring will be the king of Israel. He has no idea that his offspring will save the world. He has no idea that this young woman who has lost so much is going to be the grandmother of kings or even his wife. He's just doing life. Loving, dealing with loss, building a legacy before he ever knew he had one. Let's stand together. You know, as our prayer team members gather this morning, can I just tell you that, you know, oftentimes there's this sense of that, like, I need, you know, to say something really profound for you to, so you'll come to the altar and get some prayer and let God work in your life or whatever. But can I just tell you that in all honesty, you know, the most profound way that God moves in your life really is in those ordinary events. It's the way that we live our life out of the center of who we are and who that center really is. Whether that center is just all about us, or whether the center of our lives is Jesus Christ. See, when Jesus Christ is the center of your life, it begins to change the way that you perceive everything in your life, every person in your life, every relationship, every connection. It begins to affect the way that you see the waitress when you're eating dinner with people. It begins to affect the way that you see the person who's standing at the counter who's making change. It begins to affect the way that you see the person who pulled in front of you or who was passing you on the wrong side or whatever else. It begins to affect the way that you relate to the people that you work with. It begins to affect the way that you relate to the people who come to your counter, the people that you're making change for, the people that you're serving food. See, for the better part of the 20th century, the church has spent most of its life staring at the back of each other's heads, becoming religious consumers of religious goods and services. We drive things by programs and by how great the band is or the speaker or whatever else. And that's the way that we measure most of Christianity. It's extremely ineffective. It's extremely ineffective. See, in the midst of doing those things, it's true that we've built bigger churches, but yet percentage-wise, less of our nation is Christian than it was before. Percentage-wise, we know that not a single county in the United States of America has experienced church growth in over 40 years. What I'm asking you to do in considering building a legacy is to move from that place of Christian consumerism to a place of making Jesus the center of your life. Really, honestly, reorienting the way that you do life and business and work and relationships and how you relate to your money and to the things that you have and to the car that you drive and to the people that you encounter through the lens of finishing well. Through the lens of living an extraordinary life in the midst of ordinary things. And so if you've already got that down, then there's nothing to pray about. Actually, let me suggest something. If you've already got that down, would you please, for heaven's sake, will you please turn around and pray with everyone else around you? And would you start discipling all those other people so that they would live and walk like you do? I mean, if you've already heard it all and already know it all, but if you haven't, can I invite you to pass along what you do have to him who has none? Can I invite you to stop and take this moment and say, you know, Lord, this is the year for me that where I move from a place of consumerism to being a kingdom-centered person, a Jesus-hearted person, where the ebb and flow of my life, where the very nature of who I am and what I am doing is because there's a calling on my life to be the people of God in the place where I live, in my Bethlehem, in my field, with my workers. And that both the neighbors and the foreigner and the stranger and the distant relative would know the goodness of God in whom they've taken refuge because of the faithfulness of how I've lived my life. It's a really simple invitation. If you're struggling with that this morning, let me just invite you. Would you come get some prayer? You could get prayer for any number of things, but let me invite you to live that life and build a great legacy. In Jesus' name.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast today. And if you did, there's two things I'd love to ask of you. Number one, would you subscribe to our show? That way, the most recent podcast will be in your feed, ready for you when you are. And secondly, if this ministry has impacted you and you'd like to help us continue to reach others, you can click on the link in the description to give now.